Last time we were together, we were in the prophetic book of Isaiah, and we finished chapter 35. Well, it's interesting that chapter 36 has a historical event that it starts talking about, as if it were a history book. And that's because Isaiah is living through this time period that's described in this history section. We can pin it down to a date. Let's read it first. Isaiah 36:1 says, "In the 14th year of King Hezekiah," and I think that's counted from when he was declared crown prince by his father Ahaz. So I think we're talking about 715 BC here. "Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them." Now, Tiglath-Pileser died in 727 BC. So just a couple of years before Samaria was attacked by the Assyrian Empire. His son took over. And he's the one that was involved, and this is Shalmaneser, who started the process of taking over northern Israel and destroying Samaria. But then he dies, and so another son of Tiglath-Pileser takes over. His name is Sargon II. And so he kind of finishes up the desolation of Samaria and northern Israel and the deportation of the Israelis that survived, and then the importation of foreigners into the desolated land of northern Israel. And so in 715 BC, Sargon is the actual king of the Assyrian Empire. But he sends his son out to do a lot of the military work. This has been suggested by Bible historians as to why then Sennacherib is styled as king of Assyria at this time when he wasn't yet on the throne. It's because he will eventually be king, and he is acting on behalf of his father. Okay, so we know in 715 that the Assyrian Empire decides it's time to clean up the lower Middle East of that one little bubble of resistance known as Judea, specifically the capital city of Jerusalem. Keep your place in Isaiah 36. We'll be back there in a moment. Go over to the historical book of 2 Chronicles and see how the prophet writer there describes this same event. 2 Chronicles 32:1. "After these things and these acts of faithfulness," so it was a reference to the great revival of King Hezekiah after he became solo king. "After these things and these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and encamped against the fortified cities, thinking to win them for himself." So, like I said, the Assyrians think it's time to make Judah part of their empire. Verse 2, "When Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and intended to fight against Jerusalem." Now, we knew that was coming prophetically. The prophets had been saying the Assyrians will come against Judah, but they'll never take Jerusalem. So Hezekiah is aware of that, and he responds accordingly. Verse 3, "He planned with his officers and his mighty men to stop the water of the springs that were outside the city, and they helped him. a great many people were gathered, and they stopped all the springs and the brook that flowed through the land, saying, why should the kings, plural, of Assyria come and find much water? Now, what this means is that in this particular year, as they got notice from spies way far north, from people on watch, that the Assyrians were on the move, that they were moving south, that they had in mind taking Judea, taking Jerusalem, King Hezekiah and his leadership council say, well, if they're going to siege us, we don't want them having fresh water. And so they went out and intentionally stopped up with rocks all of the wells, all of the water source entry points, anywhere close to Jerusalem. They also apparently stopped the fresh water of the Gihon Spring, which is inside the walls of Jerusalem at this time. It's on the east side, overlooking the Kidron Valley. In ancient times, the water from the Gihon poured out of a whole bunch of openings along that east side of the walls of Jerusalem and watered all of the Kidron Valley. And people had lots of crops and gardens that they grew down there. And so Hezekiah says, no, we got to stop that. So they stop up the Gihon Spring and they dry up all those water channels. But they send the water from the Gihon Spring to a different place. And we'll read about that in a moment. But keep that in mind. Okay, verse 5. He set to work resolutely and built up all the wall that was broken down and raised towers upon it. And outside it, he built another wall and he strengthened the Milo in the city of David. The Milo seems to be a breastwork that's on the east side, a retention wall on the east side of the old palace of King David, and then for a short period of time, of King Solomon. If you go to Israel and you go to the ancient city of David archaeological park, they will show you a great stone structure that was most likely that palace. And on the east side of it, they will show you the walls of the retention wall. That's the Milo that we're talking about here. So Hezekiah is looking at the walls of Jerusalem, including the most ancient ones. And he says, some of these things need to be repaired real quick. And so they do that. Some of them need to have towers placed so that we can keep an eye on anybody outside the wall. So they do that. And then they make that Milo even stronger. They also build a secondary wall as kind of something to slow the enemy down. So he's doing a lot of reinforcement work to try to slow down the Assyrians. He also made weapons and shields in abundance. Not surprising that he would do that. Verse 6, he set combat commanders over the people and gathered them together to him in the square at the gate of the city and spoke encouragingly to them. Again, not surprising he would do this. He musters the forces, so he calls out the militia to reinforce the standing army, and he talks to everybody from the commanders down in a public assembly. Verse 7, be strong and courageous. That's echoing past words of God and of leaders getting the people ready for a tough time. Do not be afraid or dismayed before the king of Assyria and all the hordes that's with him, for there is more with us than with him. Greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world, right? There is always a majority on God's side, because God is on that side. And so that is what he's trying to communicate to his people. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the arm of our God to help us and to fight our battles. Amen and amen to that. And so the people took confidence from the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. I think they probably also took confidence from the words of the prophets previous to this, that even though they would be invaded and lose some of the fringe areas of Judah, Jerusalem would never fall to the Assyrians. Verse 30 in this chapter is the part that I wanted to come back to. Verse 30, this same Hezekiah closed the upper outlet of the waters of the Gihon and directed them down toward the west side of the city of David. Now, many people believe that that is a reference to Hezekiah's tunnel, otherwise known as the Siloam Tunnel, because it feeds the Siloam Pool, which is in the south end of the ancient city of David. Again, if you go there to Israel today, there is major archaeological work that has happened at the Pool of Siloam. When I was there the last time in 2022, very little of the pool was showing. A significant archaeological evidence for it, but not all of it. Now, apparently, they have uncovered most, if not all of it, and many of the steps that led up from the Pool of Siloam. So we know that the tunnel feeds the water from the Gihon Spring into that pool. And so some people think that Hezekiah was the one who dug that pool, not personally, but had it done. And it is an amazing engineering feat, 1,400 plus feet. The workers, we know historically, started at both ends, some at Gihon, some at Siloam, and they dug through based on the softness of the rock and things like that until they met with each other. And they were not very far apart when they met. So amazing engineering, because this is all happening like 150 feet underground. I have never walked through Hezekiah's tunnel. One of these days when I get back over there, that's on my bucket list I'm going to do. I've always walked instead through one of the Canaanite tunnels that the waters of the Gihon used to flood through, but which is now dry, and so you don't have to get wet to go through it. Also, I happen to think that it was one of those tunnels that Joab came through and took the city of Jebus from the Canaanites. And so that's one of the reasons I like to go through that particular tunnel. But yes, Hezekiah's tunnel may have been dug by Hezekiah's guys at this time. However, there are some people that say that Hezekiah's tunnel, or the Siloam tunnel, is a little bit older than Hezekiah's time, and so it may have come from a previous time where they wanted to bring water to the other side of the city of David. I'm not really on board with that belief system, but I'm open to checking out the archaeology for it as the information comes out. But the point is, Hezekiah dried up all the water near Jerusalem and kept all the water of the Gihon inside the walls of the city, preparing for siege. Now let's go back to chapter 36 of Isaiah. And the information is also in 2 Chronicles 32, but I want to read from the prophet's account of this. Verse number 2, Isaiah 36. The king of Assyria sent the Rabshaka, which seems to be a title, something about the big guy, from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem with a great army. So what we know is that when the Assyrians came under Sennacherib, they started taking the outer fortified protection cities before moving on Jerusalem. But they still put Jerusalem under siege to start with because they don't want them getting supplies. So the Sennacherib is actually fighting against one of the fortified support cities, Lachish, which is southwest of Jerusalem, about a day's journey. So the big guy, Rabshakeh, he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. So he comes to some point, I believe, on the west side of the city of Jerusalem, somewhere near where there was a waterway. There came out to him Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. So King Hezekiah doesn't come out. He is too valuable to be at risk in a peace talk. So this is a conference to try to get the Israelis, that is the Judeans, to surrender to the Assyrians. Let us just take over your country. You can be one of our client kingdoms. You can be one of our tributaries. So Rabshakeh said to them, "You say to Hezekiah, 'Thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours?'" So what makes you so confident that you can resist the Assyrians? "Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me?" Now that reminds us that Hezekiah had apparently in the past sent some tributary money up to the Assyrians to say, here's some financial stuff, here's some things of value, leave us alone. And so now that he's not doing that on a regular basis, the Assyrians are like, "Hey, who do you think you are? Not giving us what you should be giving us. Behold, you're trusting in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." We talked about this in our prophecy passages recently. Hosea, the king of northern Israel, had reached out to the Pharaoh of Egypt in hopes of getting some Egyptian support to resist the Assyrians. And he was warned that wasn't going to do any good, that Egypt would not help them out, and then they'd be in trouble. And that's exactly what happened. The king in Egypt right now is, So is the shortened form of it, just S-O. He was having problems of his own, trying to keep control of the Delta region. So he's not really interested in helping Israel or now Judah. And the Assyrians are aware of that. And so they mock the idea of looking to the Egyptians. They're just a broken reed. It'll just poke you in the hand. Don't be looking to them. Verse 7. Now comes to the place where it gets religious. "But if you say to me, 'We trust in he who is our God,'" that's actually a line that comes in a lot of psalms that the Israelis like to sing. "We trust in the Lord our God," right? "If you say to me, 'Well, we trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall not worship before this altar? Now that's a bit of twisted history right there. You may remember that the Hezekiah revival involved going out and breaking down all of the altars, including those that were in northern Israel, that were devoted to other deities. Now, some of those deities, like the golden calves, were supposed to be representative of Yahweh, of He Who Is. They weren't, but the northern Israelis in particular acted like they were still worshiping He Who Is. Some of the people who were worshiping Baal. Baal is a title that means Lord or Master. They acted as if they were worshiping He Who Is, the God who brought Israel out of Egypt. And so what the big guy here is saying is that, come on, guys, don't you realize that King Hezekiah had you tearing down He Who Is his altars? Verse 8, come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able on your part to set riders on them. Now, I believe that King Hezekiah is following God's direction a lot more closely than his dad. I don't believe he has a cavalry. I don't believe he has a chariot force, because God had said long, long ago, don't multiply wives to yourselves as kings, don't multiply horses or chariots to yourself as kings, because wives represent political power, treaties that are made. Horses and chariots represent military power, human military power, and God didn't want them thinking that they were taking care of themselves. So, of course, they don't have a whole bunch of horsemen. So, he's making a bet here. I bet you couldn't even come up with 2,000 people to ride on horses. So, verse 9, how then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Again, making assumptions here. You think that you can get the Egyptians to come up here with their horses and with their chariots and save you? Because you don't even have that sort of stuff? Don't even think that you can stand up against my lowest skilled guy. Moreover, it is without He Who Is that I have come up against this land to destroy it. That's a question. Moreover, is it without He Who Is that I have come up against this land to destroy it? He Who Is said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Now again, the big guy here, the commander, is repeating what Sennacherib said to him, which is probably actually what Sargon also said, is don't let these Judeans say that they can be saved by the Egyptians. Don't you let these Judeans say that they can be saved by their God. Because I'm telling you right now, when my wise guys, when my soothsayers checked in with the gods of the spirit world, Yahweh himself told me to go up and take the place. And so that's the story. That's the twisted history that is being passed on. Now, verse 11 has an interesting, it's the start of a very interesting detail to all of this. Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Yoah said to Rabshakeh, because remember, they're having a little conference there on the west side of Jerusalem. And these three guys say, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall. So at this point in Israeli history, the Israelis still spoke the Hebrew of the Old Testament writings, of the writings of Moses. That was their language. They did not understand Aramaic. Now, that can be a little bit confusing historically, because in the New Testament period, the Israelis spoke Aramaic as their normal language. That happened because of them being taken into exile. But at this point, they don't understand Aramaic. It's close to Hebrew, but you might pick up a word or two here and there, but the syntax is a little bit different, all of that. So these three guys say, quit talking to us in Hebrew. Talk to us in Aramaic, because we don't want the people up there hearing our conference. But Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and drink their own urine? And I'm sure that he may have chosen words that were a little bit more rude in using that sort of scatological language. This guy says, no, I'm doing this on purpose. I was sent here not just to talk with you guys who are in the top tier. I'm here to try to convince the people to give it up. And they need to give it up because there's no hope for them. It's not going to be very long before they will be so hungry, they'll be picking through manure piles. And they'll be so thirsty that they'll be trying to figure out a way to drink their own urine. And then Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, hear the words of the king of Assyria. But we're almost out of time, so we're not going to read any of that. So we set the stage for some psychological warfare here. The big guy, Rabshakeh here, is going to try to break the fighting spirit, the resistance spirit of the people, the common people in the city of Jerusalem. And Hezekiah is going to have to turn this around to get everybody to stay on board with their trust in He who is.